Okay, let's move on to Dr. Reeves' case.
Well, this is a very spirited 82-year-old. This is a very active lady who was a polka dancer and participated in senior citizen tournaments. And about 3 years prior to our seeing her, she fractured a hip. She went into a regional hospital and had her hip fracture fixed. And at the same time, they also palpated a breast nodule. And she stated without her permission, they biopsied the nodule. And as she recovered from her hip surgeries, they told her she had breast cancer. And she was very angry and she left and she refused any follow-up. So about 3 years later, when she presented to us, a friend brought her in with a very weeping, odorous otomastectomy. She was unable to dress herself very well. She had to wash her clothing several times a day because of the oozing that was occurring. There was supraclavicular nodes positive, and there were also contralateral breast nodules as well as a lung nodule.
Let me ask you, is she symptomatic from her lung nodules?
No, okay. She was not. But she's living alone, and she's not very active at this point. Could not socialize.
And liver?
No liver mets, no. And a little bit of weight loss at that point, but not a substantial weight loss.
Bone?
No, at least not by bone scan. She was agreeable to doing treatment at that point, and her original biopsy was estrogen receptor positive, although HER2 was not done on the original sample.
So did you have a HER2 assay at that point?
I did not, no. I figured it was 3 years between time, and if it were a HER2 positive tumor, I would have expected a much more aggressive course.
Can you talk a little bit more about the woman and sort of what her thinking was?
Well, she was a very spirited person, very independent, and just was very angry that someone did something without her permission. And the denial, obviously, once it took over, was so predominant that she didn't believe that it was really a cancerous condition. She thought that this was just an infectious problem from the biopsy, I presume.
Dan, how would you think this through?
Personally, I would absolutely treat this lady with hormone therapy, and personally, I would absolutely treat her with an AI, and I would imagine that she's going to have a nice response and get lots better and really do quite well. This is the kind of patient, I'm sorry for her, and it's a tragic circumstance in terms of her having metastatic disease, but I find these people fun to treat. It's rewarding for me to see them get better, and it's rewarding for them. I actually get bored with adjuvant therapy because, I don't know about you, but it's cookie cutter. Even though there are slight differences, basically you can't change it much. This patient, you can hunt and peck and do things and see what happens when people get better. And I keep urging our residents to come down to our clinic to see what we do instead of the inpatient, because all they see are the patients that we fail. I think one issue is, would you start a bisphosphonate at this time? I'm assuming she's probably on an oral bisphosphonate because of her osteoporosis anyway, no?
Yeah, she had not been seeing anyone, No physicians or anything.
So. I mean, you might treat her bisphosphonate for other reasons, but I don't think I'd start it for cancer yet and keep your fingers crossed. I would go back and get a HER2 stain on that original, either do a new biopsy or go back and stain it. I've treated a couple of 80-year-olds with trastuzumab carefully and with my fingers crossed and with frequent echo monitoring, but I have, and you're right, it's probably negative given the indolent course, but you don't know that.
Skip, how would you approach a patient like this?
Identically, and her odds of responding are very high and not much to lose there. And you'll actually see, we've done a few neoadjuvant trials in this setting, and actually you'll see the response within a few weeks, and it tends to go pretty well.
Can you follow up with what happened with the patient?
Her position really required, from my standpoint, a rapid response because the wound was just so odorous and oozing and going through multiple gauze pads and local antibiotic regimens. So we went ahead and actually gave her Xeloda along with a course of radiation therapy to the chest wall itself. And within 3 months, the wounds had healed over completely, and she was absolutely thrilled. Her demeanor had changed. She was visiting with people again and was quite pleased, actually giving me kisses and all kinds of social interactions again. And at that point, we made a switch to the...
Isn't that rewarding, though?
It is.
Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah. And not to say it wouldn't have happened with letrozole, although I think it would have been slower. Switched her over to Femara, I believe, at that point. And subsequently, she fractured the other hip within a month of being on the Femara. And it was a non-pathologic fracture. That's been fixed. And she went through rehab, and she's going back to those things that she loves best, which is visiting with people. And she has not started dancing yet, but she certainly is going to the senior events.
Skip, what do you think about this strategy of induction? Of course, you have to kind of see the patient, and obviously you were very concerned about what was going on in her chest wall. What about this issue of short-term chemotherapy followed by long-term hormonal therapy? And also, what about the issue of synergy between capecitabine and radiation therapy?
Well, clearly, to take the second question first, I mean, 5-FU has long been one of our better radio sensitizers, and I think the idea of giving chronic oral therapy and BID dosing probably goes very well with radiation. We've certainly seen very good results, and actually, it's gone better for me with some of those types of chest wall disease than some of the problems we had with the taxanes in that setting where there was more skin damage and radiation recall phenomena, things like that. So I think capecitabine was a good choice and probably a preferable choice in the setting. I think if you're going to give her chemotherapy, that was a great one to use and to look at starting with, considering all the scenarios there. I'm very comfortable with giving a single agent chemotherapy to try to get a response, particularly if you're worried about some visceral disease or something that's in that direction of causing more concern to the patient, and then switching to a hormonal treatment. I'm also very comfortable in the scenario. I don't get very black and white over combination versus single agent. I've given a lot of combination therapy for a few cycles and then given a single agent afterwards even. So I think that's what makes it the art of medicine and not necessarily following the cookbook that is fun to do and you have to judge by seeing the patient.
I guess one of the problems, Dan, with this kind of approach, unless you see further response on the hormone, you don't really know whether it's helping or not. But what do you think about this strategy of using short-term, quote, induction chemo followed by hormones?
Looking around the room, we're all about the same age or so, and most of us are trained when chemotherapy was awful and hormone therapy wasn't awful. And it's clear in the last 5 to 10 years that's not so true anymore. Capecitabine, I think, is a terrific drug if you can get the right dose for the right patient. And it's easier to take sometimes than hormone therapy. So I have no disagreement with what you did at all there. I would argue this patient might well have had an equally brisk response to letrozole. I mean, she's real set up to be a hormone-sensitive patient. In our own center, our radiation oncologists who are pretty conservative would be reluctant to irradiate someone who still has an open weeping lesion, and they would want me to induce it into some sort of response before they irradiated it with the feeling that the radiation would not be very effective and would have been thrown away. I'm not sure that's true, and I can't find data to support it other than personal preferences, but obviously what you did worked, and that's terrific. One thing I'm surprised doing a number of consults are the number of women I see who are started simultaneously on chemotherapy and hormone therapy with metastatic disease. And perhaps I'm in the minority, but I have not seen a reason to do that. There are two concerns I have. One is that there are some preclinical and adjuvant data suggesting they may be antagonistic, that may be drug-specific and a variety of other issues, but nonetheless. And the second is that if you're trying to palliate a patient and one of them works, you don't know which it is. And there's no evidence putting them together works better. And I've never quite understood why you wouldn't, for example, try hormone therapy first, and if it works, great, and if it doesn't work, go to chemotherapy. Or if you think you're only going to get one shot, then use chemotherapy first, and then if it works, great, peel that off and go back and give hormone therapy later. I've not seen a reason to expose a patient to the side effects of both in the absence of any evidence that they're synergistic or even additive. That's not what you did, I know that, but it's just I see a lot of folks like that. Maybe I don't get it. I'd be happy to discuss that with others. So I don't know if that answered the question you asked, but
what dose of Xeloda did you use?
825 BID.
And that was during the radiation therapy?
Yes. Mm-hmm. We did it for 2 weeks and then took a week off.
Skip, I love talking to you because you're one of the few multi-tumor guys around. Skip was actually one of the authors on the EXACT trial comparing capecitabine to 5-FU in colon cancer. What about the issue of dose of capecitabine? That was very controversial in that study, and there's a lot of debate about that in breast cancer.
And I think the 825 per meter squared dose, a lot of that comes out of the GI literature and has been acceptable. And I do think one thing that is different and nice about using a thymidylate synthase inhibitor or 5-FU-like drug in the setting with radiation, you don't tend to get the skin necrosis and some of the toxicity issues we saw with the anthracyclines or the taxanes when those were tried. So that was an aggressive dose. That's a reasonable, but to a higher end dose with radiation therapy. The doses in the studies have been 650 per meter squared and 825. I was commenting earlier when Neil and I were talking that our nurses have almost banned the 150 milligram tablet. If you have just a 500 milligram tablet, it's the whole phone education, taking less or stopping and restarting just makes it much simpler. I think the radiation therapy dosing is obviously the continuous strategy while you get through the treatment. And something we've done without a lot of data to support it, but is being looked at in some studies, is to do the Monday through Friday and give the break on Saturday, Sunday to honor the radiation therapist on their day off as well. And then the week on, week off dosing. I think that that is catching on. That makes some sense. It goes nicely with some of the regimens. The dose intensity or dose density works out to be about the same in that regard. The hand-foot problems and the diarrhea problems tend to be late in the second week. So The 1,000 per meter squared BID for a week and then a week off is becoming in vogue in our practice as a better style of giving the capecitabine.
And there you're talking about as monotherapy without radiation therapy.
Correct. That's without radiation therapy. That's the standard single agent by itself.
How do you approach dosing capecitabine, Dan?
One reason I like capecitabine, for the same reasons we discussed earlier, is you can fool around with it a lot. And in the literature, your work, I'm mumbling because I'm reluctant to speak in front of Skip. He's done a lot more than I have. But it seems like as long as you give it at a reasonable dose and you give it over a reasonable amount of time, it works. We tend to use not per meter squared, but just flat 1,500 BID in an otherwise healthy woman. And I have every patient keep a diary and write her symptoms down. And I don't have any two patients getting exactly the same dose and schedule at any given time. I've done every other week, like you talked about. Some patients get to 10 days, and I give 10 days on and 7 days off. It gets onto a screwy schedule, and I don't like that, so I usually drop back to 7 on, 7 off. But 1,500 BID to me is just a nice round number. It's 3 pills in the morning, 3 pills in the evening. You don't have to cut pills in half and all the other stuff. So we just don't do it per meter squared.
And I would echo Dan's thoughts there. My pharmacologist has been a big advocate of that and done some of the work. It really doesn't make sense to spend a lot of time doing per meter squared. I do the per meter squared sort of to get a feel for what my BID dose will be. But I'm a big rounder of the dose there in that setting. It is a perfect drug for us to do some more studies with flat dosing. And certainly the Europeans are doing more in that direction of flat dosing, and that probably makes a lot of sense.
The Southwest Oncology Group is about to open a study with flat dose 1500 BID and cyclophosphamide, and we're calling this simple oral chemotherapy, so everything will be oral in this case with combination. Ann Schott is going to be the PI of this. We piloted some of this at the University of Michigan, and I think the feeling there is for people who, for example, might not have bone mets, therefore aren't getting intravenous bisphosphonates and don't want to get tethered to an intravenous therapy, they could be taking pills at home and not have to come in as often. It was very well tolerated in our pilot study at Michigan, and we'll see how it flies on the road. But
phase two?
It's a phase two, yeah.
Interesting.
It has a great acronym, though.
What is
it? Simple oral chemotherapy, so it's SOCKS. I like that. Knock your socks off.